Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. I want to talk to you about the Bose S1, which is an amazing speaker for acoustic guitars that I've been playing lately. The S1 has two separate channels. It has one for your guitar and then another one for a microphone. And then there's a third channel you can use for a looper or for backing tracks that you could access by Bluetooth or through a 1/8 inch plug. And the S1s are also very easy to carry. It's got an easy to grab top handle and absolutely anyone can tote it around. And it's also rechargeable for up to 11 hours. The S1 was specifically designed to optimize the sound of your acoustic guitar on acoustic guitar gigs. The guitar and mic channels each have separate tone, volume, and reverb controls, and there's also a proprietary tone match switch, which restores and optimizes the natural sound of your acoustic guitar, which, as you know, is typically the biggest problem with acoustic amps. Now, I tested the S1 myself, and the tone, volume, and reverb controls sound great, and they're very responsive. You can position the S1 in four different ways. You can tilt it back so you broadcast out to an audience, or you could put it horizontally, vertically, or on a stand. And the cool thing is the S1 has a Bose accelerometer, so it automatically adjusts the EQ and optimizes the sound for whichever one of these four positions you're using. The S1 also happens to be the best Bluetooth speaker that Bose makes, which is pretty compelling since Bose is known for the quality of their Bluetooth speakers. So effectively, you have an acoustic guitar amp, a PA, and a killer Bluetooth speaker all in one. And the bottom line is this. If you're an acoustic guitar player, there's absolutely nothing out there that sounds this good and this big that's also easy to carry and battery powered. As far as the Bluetooth speaker goes, I've used it many times here at home for family barbecues, and the sound is so good, my kids wind up arguing over who gets to play the music they want. You know, it's literally like having a full stereo system out on your patio. You can use the S1 for DJing, tailgating, or whatever you want. Before this, you'd have to spend a bunch of money on loads of different speakers and pedals to get the same thing the S1 does on its own. On top of that, it looks great, just like all Bose devices do. And besides whatever money back guarantee you get from wherever you buy the S1, Bose also warranties the S1 for 2 years for any kind of defects in materials or performance. For more information and to find out where to get your own S1, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/S1. That's everyonelovesguitar.com/S1. Get the S1. It's outstanding. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's ANNE at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. Man, I've got a really cool guest, a very deep cat, and this is going to be a lot of fun. We got Paul Jackson Jr. with us today, the one and only. I want to give a quick shout out to our mutual friend, Reggie Hamilton.
Yay.
Like my brother from another mother, become that. Yeah. Thank you so much, Reggie. You've been so supportive of me and of the show. So thanks for connecting me and Paul. Let's talk about Paul Jackson Jr. real quickly, and then we'll get into it. Born and based in L.A., member of numerous local bands from his early teens, including a band composed of himself and his siblings. Paul Jackson Jr. has been a first call session guitarist for over 40 years. Even though he looks like he's 35. He's played on albums by the following artists. This is like, this diversity is like mind blowing. He was on Headhunters, Herbie Hancock's record, George Benson, the Pointer Sisters, Lenny White, Stanley Turrentine, B.B. King, Sonny Rollins, Billy Preston, Joe Sample, Lamont Dozier, Donna Summer, the Jacksons. I don't usually go on this much, but this is just incredible. Jose Feliciano, Stan Getz, Aretha Franklin, Boz Scaggs, Freddie Hubbard, Alphonse Mouzon, Ella Fitzgerald, Michael Jackson, he was on Thriller and Bad, Ray Parker Jr., the Pointer Sisters, Tavares. This is just, dude, I'm getting goosebumps. This is so cool. Lionel Richie, Larry Graham, Tom Scott, Dionne Warwick, Herb Alpert, The Temptations, Ramsey Lewis, Fee Wabel of the Tubes, Roy Ayers, my wife has some Roy Ayers records. When we first got together, it was so funny. Al Jarreau, she's from the UK, that's why. Barbara Streisand, Chicago, Julio Iglesias, Michael McDonald, Stanley Clark, Earl Klugh, Roberta Flack, Barry White, the Isley Brothers, Joan Baez, Quincy Jones, Elton John, Whitney Houston, Marcus Miller, Ray Charles, Abe Laboriel, George Duke, and literally hundreds of others, man. I mean, this is just, I wanted to just read that because that was like almost, it's like almost.
Well, you left out Daft Punk and recently a session on a recording that has Nipsey Hussle on it.
So. There you go. That's almost unbelievable, man. He also has 10 solo records of his own, including Stories from Stompin' Willie, which is Paul's tribute to George Duke. And he has another record called Life and Times by his jazz funk band, Jazz Funk Soul, with Jeff Lorber and Everett Harp. Also, he's on the underscore of loads of motion pictures such as Get On Up, Zootopia, and The Color Purple. More recently, as he said, he's contributed his playing styles and composing chops to the Daft Punk CD that got 5 Grammys and was the number one album in 104 countries. Excuse me. And he gained Paul Grammy recognition for his contribution to the record. He's also taught at worship conferences all over the world, and he's an adjunct professor at the USC Thornton School of Music. I'm exhausted, man. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. It's a real treat to have you.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Cool. Yeah, man. How did you first get started in the music business, and like, what was your first break?
Wow. Two big breaks happened actually kind of simultaneously. One of them was I actually grew up down the street from Patrice Rushen.
Okay.
So, right there, that's like a, providential from God. but I joined her band when I graduated from high school. At the same time, I had been doing demos for a producer by the name of Frank Wilson, who at that time was one of the number one producers in the world. And he wrote songs like Boogie Down, Son of Sagittarius, I'm Gonna Make You Love Me, a bunch of stuff. And so I started doing sessions for him. At the same time, something kind of happened very interesting, which was Ray Parker Jr. started focusing on his group Radio. Lee Ritenour really started focusing on his solo records. And Al McKay was knee deep in Earth, Wind, and Fire. So there left, if you will, a void of a guy who could play good rhythm guitar and read music well. And because of said guys, Ray Parker Jr., Al McKay, Lee Ritenour, and Patrice Rushen, I started getting recommendations from those guys to come on sessions. And that was about middle of 1978. And the Lord blessed, and I've never looked back.
Let me ask you, how old were you when you were doing those demos for Frank Wilson?
I started doing demos for him when I was like 16 years old.
Wow. So how did you get so good at such a young age?
Well, that just a lot of practice. I mean, I remember when I decided I really wanted to go into music, I switched all my classes around in high school so I could get out at noon. So I'd go to high school from 8 o'clock to noon, take the bus home, do my homework, and then spend 4 hours practicing guitar. 4 turned into 5, 5 turned into 6. And when I was in USC, when I went to USC, I was spending like 9-10 hours a day on the guitar. I don't know how to do anything else these days, but that's what I was doing. So just really time. And then, like you said, I had a band with my family, 14 Karat Gold. I was playing with a band called Touch of Grey. I was doing demos. I was playing with the Don Johnson Society Orchestra. I was playing gigs around town with my young buddies then, Gerald Albright and Nathan East. I was, you know, anywhere I could play, I would go play. And I was playing and started playing at church. And so I just, you know, had a lot of opportunities to play, a lot of opportunities to practice. And I got to really, really thank my parents on this one because, you know, back then, you know, we have apps for everything now.
Yeah.
But back then, a metronome was a big piece of wooden box
click, click, click.
So I'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning before school and play scales. And, you know, so they're waking to the sound of tick tock, tick tock, you know, but they, to their, you know, to their credit, man, they let me practice and really supported what I did and really encouraged it. So, you know, and I told them I was going into music. Their only stipulation was go to school and learn more. So wow. I really have to credit them for allowing me the time and energy to get better. And I'll tell you another interesting story. And this is why you really have to support your kids and support your friends. And when they tell you they want to do something, really support them. Is when I was 16 or 17 years old, my dad took his Christmas bonus from work and bought me a 335.
And wow. And
I'll never forget, you know, back then a 335 was like $700, but that was really expensive.
Yeah.
Now you got to remember, I hadn't played on record the first. I was doing demos for Frank Wilson, but I hadn't played on record the first. So, you know, they believed in me, you know, and bought that 335. And so, like I said, they took a chance not knowing if I was ever going to do anything in music.
Wow. But I would imagine that belief really gave you just a tremendous level of confidence and like peace of mind to proceed.
Yeah, it would. I mean, they saw that I was serious and I was practicing a lot and I was playing gigs on weekends and, you know, so they saw that I was really focused on doing something in music. So, you know, but they went, you know, they believed in me. So
do you still have that 335?
I absolutely.
Awesome, man. That is so cool.
That absolutely.
Is very cool. The other question is, how did you get so, you were obviously very driven. Where did that hunger come from? And where did the discipline come from, not only to do that and commit to the X amount of hours and the scales and the metronome and getting up early, but you're 16 going in the studio, you had to be super cool, man. I mean, you know, because you obviously were successful at it. And part of that success in the studio is being like really cool and adaptable. And like, you want to have this kid around. Where did that maturity come from? That's unusual.
I think it came from probably watching my parents. My parents were very disciplined. I should say, well, my mom passed, but my dad's still alive. Very disciplined in terms of when you undertake something, you know, be focused at it and be the best at it. So that was my goal, is to be the best at what I was doing.
That's so cool, man. Okay, so how did you start getting your first, like, proper sessions, and then how did your career blossom from there?
Well, interesting story. Back to Frank Wilson. When I turned 18, he said, you know, I think you're ready to work on some records. So I started working on the first record I did. It's funny. It was a Lenny White record. Lenny White, former lead singer of Tower of Power.
That was your first record?
Yeah, so his first solo record, which went gold and had a couple of hits on there. And Lee Ritenour was on the record. Jay Graydon was on the record. Wawa Watson was on the record. And so these guys started recommending me for sessions. I remember, funny story, Wawa Watson, we were working on something for Frank. And he says, hey, what are you doing tonight? I said, nothing. He said, you want to work on a Donald Byrd record? I said, sure. He said, okay, show up to the studio at 7 o'clock. I said, okay, I will. He said, hey, wait a minute. Does Donald know I'm coming? He said, no, but that's okay. He'll like it. So, so these guys were really taking a chance on me, and I'd show up to sessions. I remember there was a session I did for somebody. First time I had run my guitar through a Leslie, and he said, yeah, Lee Ritenour told me to call you.
Wow.
And, yeah. And then I remember another day working for Gene Page, the great arranger Gene Page. We were, I think, working on a Johnny Mathis record. And I was reading the music and I noticed that he had written rhythms in the middle of the staff for the guitar. And so I played what he wrote and you know, he would do that several times. And so one day I asked him, I said, hey, Gene, what made you write those rhythms in the middle of the staff? He said, oh, He said, that's what I thought Ray Parker Jr. would have played. So that's where I wanted you to start. I said, okay, cool. You know, but Ray had recommended me to Gene Page.
That's amazing.
So that's how things got started. I remember doing on one session we did for Frank Wilson, Joe Sample was on the record. And Joe Sample said, hey, I want to see how you work in some other situations. So I ended up playing on Joe Sample's solo record and records for the Crusaders like Street Life and a lot of other records. So it's just really, you know, really just like I said, providential, you know, the grace of God and folks taking a chance on me. You know, everything is about relationships and somebody taking a chance on you.
Yeah. But you also sound, I mean, I get the feeling you are very open to mentorship. And when you get a young person that is as hungry as you were and willing to, young or old, when you get a person that's hungry like that and willing to like not go hang out with his buddies and do the thing he needs, that's the person you want to like mentor and shepherd through, you know?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, even now at USC, there are a number of really, really talented young people. And many of them, fortunately, have that same drive and hunger. It's like, hey, I want to succeed. Anything you ask me to do, I have a few guitar students like that, where it's like, hey, anything you tell me I should try, I'll do it. We've been talking about rebuilding pedal boards. And two of them especially have taken the leap and said, I'm going to make the investment because based on what you said and what the equipment you show me and I'm going to go ahead and take the leap. Funny story. One of the students, his dad is building the pedal board. And it's funny because my dad built my first pedal board. So,
oh, man, that's cool.
Cool. And his dad's the same age I am. So his dad sends me pictures and it's like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm working on the wiring. Where should I put the power supply? No, but it's amazing what they're doing. But it's just nice that his dad has taken the posture that my dad took, you know, around the same time. So that's really cool. But, yeah, so when you see somebody that's focused, you want to pour into them.
And it's nice you're like, I could see you're motivated to pay it forward, which is really cool as well, man. Okay. So as I mentioned, the diversity of your work is pretty amazing. And I know you're not a guy that likes to brag on himself and I'm not trying to put you in an awkward situation, but what is it, two questions, that allows you to play at such a high level on all these different genres, and why do you think you've gotten the call? Because it goes beyond technical, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I learned early on is the number one goal of a, you know, I guess a musician in general, but I guess in my case, a guitarist, the number one goal is to make the music feel good. That's the number one thing. Steve Lukather wrote a book and he was being interviewed, and Luke, still to this day, is probably singly my favorite, definitely one of my favorite soloists in history. I mean, he just makes that guitar sing.
Yeah.
But he was in an interview and he said the number one goal of a guitar player is to make the track feel good. And if you think about it, regardless of what the genre is, I mean, you look at a guy like Freddie Green with the Count Basie Orchestra. His goal was to make the music feel good. If you look at Joe Perry, some of the like cool riffs he's come up like, you know, with like on Walk This Way or Dude Looks Like a Lady or, you know, name it, makes it feel good.
Yeah.
So the number one goal of a guitarist is to make the track feel good. And so that's always been my focus. And then something else that Ray Parker Jr. told me years ago is that playing solos on records is few and far between. So for every guitar solo you hear, there were, at least back in the day, for every guitar solo you hear, there were probably 10 songs recorded that didn't have a guitar solo.
Sure.
So, you know, so that's the thing is still, you know, how, before you get to the solo, before you get to the lead parts, before you get to the instrumental breakdown, how are you going to make the song feel good?
Which is a big difference in your state of mind between how do I make the record sound good, actually.
Mm-hmm.
No one's ever said that to me before. Everybody like, I want to serve the song, but there's a difference between making it sound good and making it feel good, because there's a different mindset, you know, in your personal vibe as you go in there, what you're looking to do. And yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. Okay, I'm going to just start mentioning some artists, Paul. If you could tell me how you first hooked up with them and, you know, you probably got hundreds of stories, but any kind of knee-jerk reaction, a cool or interesting story that comes to mind. Start with Quincy Jones.
I hooked up with Quincy Jones, I think, because I've been doing some work with Michael Jackson, and also probably got recommended by Wawa Watson and Lee Ritenour to go and work with him. So the first record I did with him, first project, was a record for James Ingram called It's You Tonight. After that, we went into doing the Thriller record, and years later, still working with Quincy.
That's awesome. When you did Thriller, did you think, oh my God, like, did you have any inkling of how big it would be?
No. I mean, I knew it was going to be a hit record because Off the Wall had sold like 5-6 million records already.
Right.
But in terms of, you know, I guess it, to this date, it's like 100 million records. I had no idea.
Everything you've done has brought you opportunities. Does something like that, that's just an insanely popular record, does that bring different kinds of opportunities than, you know, a record that I'll say only sells 500,000 copies? Mm-hmm.
I would say yes, because people want to be associated with success.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, you know, when you go to the store to buy, aspirin.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, what do they advertise on television? What did my mother use? You know, what did the folks, you know, when I went over, said, what kind of aspirin they have? Okay, give me that kind of aspirin.
Yeah.
Well, same thing. People want to be associated with things that are familiar and things that are successful. So it's like, okay, well, who are the guys that played on Thriller? Well, who did this? Funny story. Bruce Sweetin, the engineer. He mixes with what he calls the Acousonic mixing process, which is centered around the things that he does himself. And I will not disclose what he does.
It's like the recipe for a KFC here, right?
Right. But basically, people would call him saying, yeah, can I, you know, I want to get that Acousonic mixing process, you know,
right on.
Because of all the success it was. Yeah, we want to use that, you know. But it was centered around something that he did, and only he did at that time, that you can't really separate it, but people wanted it because it was successful.
Yeah. Very cool, man. Herbie Hancock.
Wow. Well, the first time I actually worked with Herbie was not actually on Headhunters. I was in junior high school when that came out. I worked with Herbie on a record with Alphonse Muzan.
Okay. Oh, great.
And then went to work with him on several other projects, including recently we did something at the Hollywood Bowl. It's about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, where we did Herbie Hancock with the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra. So it's been on and off through the years working on really different records and different projects. But the first time I actually worked with him was a record that I did with Alphonse Muzan.
God, with the talent here that you're like, the talent that you have been associated with, and that you have, I mean, you yourself, it's just like, it allows you to operate at such a high level, man. You know, being around all these incredible musicians.
I've been really, really fortunate, really, you know, really blessed by the Lord. I just, you know, still just, you know, riding the wave and having a good time. And, you know,
that's awesome.
There's a scripture in the Bible that says your gifts will make room for you and bring you before great men. And I can really say that in my life, that's been true and fortunately continues to be true. This past Sunday, I was fortunate to do the Oscars for the second time. You know, and you know, you're sitting there and you're looking around. There's Brad Pitt, there's Cynthia Erivo, there's, you know, Joaquin Phoenix, there's all these folks, you know, and you're going, you know, man, am I really at the Oscars? You know,
so you have a pinch me moment as well.
Yeah, sitting next to one of my heroes, Dean Parks, and I go on, and you know, I've been working with Dean literally for 4 years, and you kind of go, wow, you know, how did I get here? You know, so I'm still enjoying the ride, man.
Man, that's great. Well deserved. Stanley Clark, man, one of my favorite musicians.
Stanley, I think I started working with as a result of my relationship with George Duke. I was doing a lot of records with George and playing a lot live with George. And Stanley started to call me to do some of his records and also a lot of the movies that he was scoring.
Do you like doing movies?
Love it. A lot of fun. Yeah.
You're the kind of guy, man, I don't think you don't like. And he just seemed like to be pretty filled with joy, man. So you're probably pretty amenable to working in a lot of different situations just because you're, I don't know, you just seem like that guy, you know?
Oh, man.
B.B. King.
B.B. King. The Crusaders were producing a record on B.B. King. And so showed up at the studio, and there were the Crusaders. There was Dean Parks and yours truly, and obviously B.B. King. And so we did a record. I can't remember the name of the project. It was around 1981. That's, you know, and there's a great picture that someone took. I got to find it in the studio of all the Crusaders, Dean Parks, B.B. King, and myself. I had hair then. And
I remember those. But
I see you and I are sporting the same hair.
Yeah, man, we use the same barber.
Yeah, you know. So Gillette.
right on.
So it was a call by Wilton Felder to come and work on the record.
What was that experience like working with B.B.? Did you get to chat with him a lot or?
Absolutely. It was amazing because between takes and between songs, he would tell stories.
Oh, wow.
And he just, you know, and I'm just, you know, I'm a, you know, 20 something year old kid. So I'm just sitting there going, wow, you know, and he's telling all these stories of, you know, of his travels and his adventures and stuff. It was just amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Was when you heard over the monitors, when you heard B.B. King, was that weird?
No, it wasn't weird. It was just, you know, exciting, you know. Yeah. You know, like you said, once again, a pinch myself moment. It's like I'm in the studio with B.B. King, you know. So
Billy Preston, talk about a talent, man.
Billy, I worked with on and off over the years, usually was on a situation where we would be recording for someone else.
Okay.
And then a few years ago, Billy actually played organ on one of my records because of a buddy of mine. I can't remember Alan's last name. Oh, shoot. But anyway, Billy, yeah. But it was through, you know, working on different records, different gospel records, different pop records, that I got a chance to work with Billy. So it's just, you know, just off and on over the years.
Talented cat, man. Yeah. Stan Getz. I thought you'd be too young to work with Stan Getz.
He was doing a record that Lalo Schifrin was producing. Hmm. And I worked some a lot. Well, actually, not a lot, but some quite a few times with Lalo. And this was a record that Lalo was doing. And I remember Stanley Clark was actually also on the record. So, just once again, just got the call from Lalo to do it.
Aretha. I'm like reading these names and I can't imagine. This is like a regular day for you, which is so cool, man.
The first time I worked with Aretha, it was a session. I can't remember who the producer was. I think it was an arranger by the name of McKinley Jackson. And this is early 80s, worked on a record called United Together, which was kind of a pop hit that she had, kind of a ballad. But over the years, doing different things like the Kennedy Center Honors and different things for BET and a lot of times. So I worked with her several times over the years.
Anything? Did you learn anything from working with her? Because she just seemed like a force of energy, man.
Well, I learned the same thing from her that I learned from working with Joe Williams. We did we're doing a live TV show on the jazz singer Joe Williams. Actually, I did a record with Joe Williams as well. And what I learned is that when you are a professional, you are blessed to perform right now. I remember Joe Williams, we were doing a live TV show. Joe Williams walks in, grabs the mic and starts singing and starts killing it. Same thing with Aretha Franklin. Same thing with Beyonce. Same thing with a lot of folks. They're just, you know, hey, it's time to perform. Let's go. Yeah. And so that's what I learned is that, you know, there's, folks, well, what's my motivation? You know, I got to have my entourage. I got to have this. I got to have that. It's like, no. And I think that's one of the things that I really do like about Beyonce is that she's flat out talented. And it's like, okay, let's go. Right now, she's, you know, she's ready. She's old school.
She's on it.
Yeah.
That's great. You mentioned Ray Parker Jr. a couple of times. How'd you initially connect with Ray?
He and I have a mutual friend, Ollie Brown. Ollie Brown, drummer, amazing drummer. Played live with the Rolling Stones when Billy Preston was on tour with them. Also, you know, just a lot of sessions with different folks. Ollie and Ray, they were playing Stevie Wonder's band together, both from Detroit.
Okay.
And so Ollie told Ray about me. And so then I met Ray and we became friends. And to this day, we're all still like, you know, great friends.
That's so
but that's
cool.
How I met Ray. And a funny story is Ray had a studio and he's recording a record, a song called It's All in the Way You Get Down. So I showed up at the studio just to say hi. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm playing guitar on All in the Way You Get Down. He says, here, he hands me his guitar and he said, play something. So I did. And it's like, it was funny. It's like, why am I playing guitar on a Ray Parker Jr. record? You know? But, and then later, actually a couple of times, I've been to Japan with him recently. A couple of years ago, I went to Japan to play the Blue Notes. And it was funny because at rehearsal, he had booked 6 hours for rehearsal. I come to rehearsal and listening to his records was really the way I learned to play rhythm guitar and stuff that he had played sessions on. So I get to rehearsal. I'd written out all my parts, written all his parts. And he says, okay, this song, we rehearsed probably an hour and 15 minutes. It's like, okay, we're done. Let's go have lunch. And then we went to Japan and we're playing and I realized, man, I really learned a lot in terms of playing guitar from listening to Ray. And I really didn't realize it until I'm standing behind him, listening to him play. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that's where I got this from. And that's where I got this from. And that's where I got this from. I just borrowed it from Ray. But yeah, so he's been one of my best friends for several years, but it was because of Ollie Brown.
But man, your work ethic, that here you are 40 years in your career and you're not taking anything for granted. You're going in there with charts, not just your charts, his chart. I mean, you're doing the same diligence that you probably did when you were 16.
Yeah.
Learning stuff. That is, to me, what separates the in any endeavor, professionals from almost professionals, you know, the commitment, the diligence.
It's something I learned on the road when I was on the road with Whitney Houston, is her show was a 2-hour show. And if I would just, you know, go in, you know, we'd do the sound check and then the show would be hours later. But if I didn't, I realized that I would go in and I wouldn't play the show as well as I wanted. So what I started doing was right before the show, I would take my guitar and play the show in the dressing room. Okay, this is this song, this is this song, this is this transition, this is the, you know. So I would make my mistakes in the dressing room as opposed to on stage. And once again, doing a TV show with Arturo Sandoval. Hmm. And so I'm sitting, before we hit the stage, I'm sitting doing this, and he says, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm running through the show. And he said, why? I said, because I want to make my mistakes here as opposed to on the stage. And he said, I want you to tell my students, and he filmed me saying that. And that's the thing is that, you know, and I'll tell you who else does it to the nth degree is Paul Gilbert.
I had Paul on the show, man. Yeah. He is super, super diligent, man. Yeah.
Yeah. If you see Paul before one of his shows, he's backstage, you know, shedding, doing this, you know, same thing. It's like, you know, you'll get some ideas, but for me, it's like, I want to make my mistakes here as opposed to out there.
Yeah, man, that's very cool. But that's the pro, man. I mean, seriously, that's the professional in music and in anything, you know, you want to bring your A game and that's how you do it, you know? Talk about George Duke and then talk about anybody else that you think is kind of interesting.
Oh, it's up to you.
No. Let's talk about George because I know you have a special relationship.
I met George because he was producing a record on Lynn Davis. And Lynn Davis and I had worked together with Patrice Rushen and grew up in the same neighborhood. And I'd known Lynn for years. So she took me over to George's house to meet him. She's like, I want Paul to play on my record. So I played on Lynn's record and then played on another record and another record and another record. And so I ended up working with George pretty much until he passed away, both in the studio and live in his band. So a lot of TV shows with him as well. So just George was amazing. George had the distinction of being able to play any style well, play anything well, play any keyboard well, also arrange, you know, orchestrate and, you know, work right for TV and film. And there aren't too many people like that, you know, who are able to do that. Patrice Rushen is another one. Patrice is probably the only woman I know that can do all of it and also had hit records. So, you know, so working with George was fantastic because you never knew what it was going to be musically or where it was going to go. And George did something for me that I'll never forget, among other things he did. He had a song called Bus Tours that at that time was the hardest piece of music I'd ever seen. Odd meters and, you know, just, you know. And I said, George, I can't play this. He said, yeah, you can. He said, here, I'll give you the music. Come back tomorrow. So I went home and practiced it. And there's a song by George Duke called Bus Tours that I played on that singly, like I said, is the hardest piece of music one of the hardest pieces of music at that time it was that I'd ever played. And it was because George believed that I could do it, that I was able to pull it off.
You know, I've watched a lot of videos of George. One of the things about that guy, he just seemed to have so much joy.
Oh yeah.
He just seemed really happy to be where he was.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. He all the time.
How did he come up with Stompin' Willie?
Ah, that's funny. Well, I would go to the studio and he'd say, PJ, in his big voice, PJ. Then he started calling me PJ Wiggles. His song called Wiggles. So he started PJ Wiggles. PJ Wiggles went to PJ Wigglestomp. That went to Wigglestomp. Then it went to Stompin' Willie. That's what I'm going to call you, Stompin' Willie. So for probably the last 5 years of his life, I was Stompin' Willie.
That's hilarious, man. It's like an evolution of your nicknames that have nothing right to do with your reality. That's so funny, man.
Stompin' Willie.
That's so funny, man. Very cool. Knee-jerk reaction. I know this is a tough question. Top three sessions you've done and why?
Wow.
Just the ones that meant the most to you for whatever reason. You know, not success. I mean, just the ones that you
one
know.
Would be the Ella Fitzgerald record, because I'm working with my mother's hero and obviously one of my heroes. Probably the first time I worked with George Benson, once again, one of my heroes.
Yeah, what was that like?
It was amazing. I mean, I got the call to go to New York by Arif Mardin. And he's producing a record on George. And I'll never forget, funny story. We're in the studio and I had a Les Paul and with probably, I think, tens on it. And he shows up at the studio. He's like, "What you got there?" I said, "Oh, I got a Les Paul." He said, picks it up, plugs it in. Strings are a little light. Bling, ding, 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 ding. Hey, feels good. Here you go. Like, so that was, yeah, but probably first time I worked with George. And let me think. I would say playing on the song "This Is It."
Why is that?
Michael had passed away, and to hear his voice after he was gone was kind of surreal.
Yeah.
When it's like, okay, we're doing this record, we're going to put it out. And that was very surreal. So maybe those three. That's kind of hard to say, but maybe those three.
And live?
Live, without a doubt, playing with Whitney Houston in South Africa. I remember being on stage and they opened the curtain and seeing 100,000 people in a soccer stadium. And it was the first time apartheid had recently ended. Mm. So it was either the first or one of the first concerts where everybody could come together in the same venue.
Wow. So
you had white folks, you had colored folks, you had all kinds of different folks. And it was one of the first times that they could come together.
Dude, and that was 95. That's pretty.
100,000 people there. It's mind boggling.
Yeah.
Not 95.
Yeah.
So that would be one. Being on stage with George Benson and B.B. King at the Montreux Jazz Festival. That would be another. And trying to think. What would be another one? Oh, shoot. First time playing the Hollywood Bowl. I don't remember when it was or what it was, but I remember I was doing a jazz festival and I was being featured. And I'm looking out in the Hollywood Bowl and I remembered, or my mom actually remembered me. She said, "Well, you remember when you were a kid?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, I used to take you there to the rehearsals because," and this is good to know, "is that at the Hollywood Bowl during the afternoon, whatever the show is during sound check, you can come in and watch for free."
Oh, wow.
People can bring their kids and, you know, you can just go and say, "Hey," you just tell the parking guy, "Hey, I'm just going to watch the rehearsal." And I think you get there about, you know, 1 o'clock, and then you have to leave about four. But she used to take me and my brothers and sisters to the rehearsal to hear the orchestra. So probably first time playing the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah, that because that kind of brought you around full circle.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, man, that's very cool. Thank you for sharing that, man. You originally grew up in L.A.?
Born and raised in South Central Los Angeles, yes.
What? And it sounds like you had a really good childhood, pretty much.
Fantastic. I mean, you know, I have great parents, and we just had fun together. I mean, you know, parents invested in us, and they, you know, we do gigs together, and my mom would sing, and my dad, another funny story. I got a story. That's what happens. Old guys have stories.
I know, so, man.
These are what I call geezer reference. That's cool. Another geezer reference, okay?
Yes, man. Keep them going.
Growing up, my dad's favorite artist was Jimmy Smith, organ trio thing. So we'd listen to Jimmy Smith.
That guy, I listened to him. I just listened to him last week. Oh, man, yeah. That guy.
But that was his thing. Jimmy Smith, you know, so Groove Holmes, all that kind of stuff, you know. Actually, even Don Shirley, he listened to. Jimmy Smith had a supper club in Los Angeles. And one night after a session, a buddy of mine, Sonny Burke, great keyboard player, says, we're going to go to Jimmy Smith's. I said, okay, I'll go with you. So I brought my guitar and Sonny played organ, great organ player. And then I sat in with Jimmy and he said, hey, what are you doing tomorrow night? I said, nothing. He said, come back. So I came back and I brought my dad.
Oh, my God. Wow. Right.
So my dad got to see me play with Jimmy Smith.
Man, honestly, he had to be like over the moon.
He was on cloud nine. He's like, man, my son's finally made it. You know,
yeah.
He's like,
well, I mean, do you have kids?
I do have kids.
So you could imagine,
right?
With your own kids, seeing like how your dad must have felt, that had to be so amazing for him.
It was amazing. Yep.
Absolutely. And for you too, like a great bonding moment to share.
Oh, it was great.
Gift you gave him.
My daughter spent a year singing with Natalie Cole, background.
Wow.
And I've worked a lot with Natalie over the years, tons, and we were very good friends. And just like you said, to see her singing with Natalie Cole was amazing.
Yeah, that's, man, that's worth everything.
Yeah.
That's really priceless. What kind of work did your dad do? You mentioned him.
So my dad was an electrical engineer for an aerospace firm, and my mom was a school psychologist.
Wow, they were working. So they set really good. You had like very good examples of and work ethic, you know, parenting. That's awesome, man.
Yep. That's what kept me studying. I think that's one of the things that keeps me studying today. There's always something to learn. You know, Dean Parks and I have a joke. Dean Parks is an excellent pedal steel player.
I didn't know that.
And so he's excellent, you know. And we did a gig, and he it was just a little club that he plays at. And he called me to play banjo because he knew I'd been working on banjo. And I saw him when I saw him at the Oscars. I said, okay, well, it's back to shedding banjo. <You know? laughs> There's always something to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that saying, school's never out for the pro.
Yeah, interesting. Never heard of it. Yeah.
Very, very true, man. Low points. What were some of the low points or dark periods you've had to deal with, and how'd you get through them?
It would probably be three deaths. When George Duke passed away, that was really, really rough because, like I said, we were very, very close. When Whitney passed away, probably... Well, not just she was so young, but also because of how people had really tried to demonize her name and some of the things they said about her. And the part of Whitney that nobody said is that during the 5 years I spent with her, she was one of the best people to work for I'd ever worked for. She took care of the band. She took care of the singers, took care of everybody. It was like a big family. And she did something that I'll never forget. We were touring the States, and we had 10 buses. Every bus had a number. Band had a bus, singers had a bus, dancers had a bus. And there was bus number 10. And I said, what's bus number 10? I said, oh, that's the kids bus. And I'm like, the what? The kids bus. She said, yeah. So anybody who had kids, who had to watch their kids, could bring them on the road. And she had an aunt named Aunt Bay and a couple of women who would be on the bus to watch the kids. Now, here's the interesting thing. The bus was $600 a day plus the fuel, plus the driver, plus the driver's hotel room, and you know, plus the driver's hotel room. So she was spending in excess of $5,000-$6,000 a week to take care of other people's kids.
That's unheard of.
Right. That's my point. Nobody talks about that. You know.
Wow. Man, that was I'm glad you brought that out and said that, because it's
Yeah,
that's really nice. And man, you know what? Everybody's got demons.
Everybody's got some stuff. You know
and it's just, you know, by the grace of God, for some people that you could handle them, and what your coping skills are at whatever given point in time.
Right. So, you know, and then probably, and third was definitely when my mother passed.
Yeah, sorry, man.
Yeah. That had to be, that was, yeah, that sorry, was a rough, man. Yeah, that was a rough one, you know.
How long ago was that?
2 years. About I'm 2 years. Yeah. She, you know,
it's take your time, man.
You know, definitely. You know, all the things that I've gotten to do was because of her and my dad. So that was rough. That was that was rough. You know, so probably those three. You know, I remember going to the studio.
Dude, you got me crying.
I have her at home.
If I was there, we'd give each other a hug.
Yeah, I you know, I remember. I told my wife. Well, she was there. I went in my studio at home. And I went in and I looked around. I just walked out. So about 2 weeks later, I walked in and it was like a voice said, "What are you doing, you knucklehead? I worked too hard to make sure that you'd be successful. You need to start playing again." So after 2 weeks, I kind of shook out of it. But yeah, that had to be the low point, you know.
Thank you, man. It was very kind of you to share that. And I'm sorry for your loss, man.
I tell people it's a club that you never want to join, you know. Fortunately, you know, most of us have to join it. You know? Yeah. So,
What were, thank you again, man. It was very kind of you to share that.
Yeah.
What were some things that you did maybe that you were maybe out of your comfort zone at the time, but hindsight 2020, you're really happy you did them. Oh, got you smiling. That's good.
I'll tell you a big one, because we were talking about it actually this weekend. Years ago, Dean and I did a record for a Brazilian artist named Roberto Carlos. Mm. And it was a country record. And they had flown in Billy Joe Walker from Nashville to play this record. So the first 2 days were Billy and Dean playing some of the hardest acoustic stuff I'd ever seen. All I had to play was backbeats. Jank, bleedoo, jank, 2 days. I'm breezing. The third day was flat pick chicken picking day. All they had to do was strum. All the country fills, all the bends had to come from yours truly.
Oh, man.
Billy Walker could have done it in his sleep. Dean, obviously, the joke with Dean is that everything he does is well done. Dean always plays the perfect thing, you know, like, you know, the way he played the opening of Josie. Everything he does is like that, perfect. So I'm like, "Dean, you gonna help me out?" Or he's like, "Nope, you got it." So for the whole day, I'm trying to think of every country lick I'd ever heard on any record to get through the session. So that was one.
And it worked, obviously.
It worked. Yeah, it worked pretty well. Yeah, it worked well. Obviously, the aforementioned bus tour from George Duke. Recently did a movie. It was a lot of fun, called Call of the Wild. It just came out, a Harrison Ford movie. And the director, John Powell, was kind of neat. He called 15 guitar players.
For audition?
No, for session.
Wow. So that was like a big hangout.
Yeah, it was so, Andrew Senowick and George Deering and Dean Parks and Tim May and, Paul Viapiano and Tom Rotella and I'm leaving guys out. Joe Diori, not Joe Diori, I'm sorry, forgive me, he's bad. But all these guys playing banjo, mandolin, steel string, and nylon. And that was that was like, how do I get through the, you know, he'd written out all this stuff and you know, everybody played and it was good, but you kind of go, wow, what was that? You know, it was amazing, you know. And so we had a really good time, but you kind of go, wow, that was, you know, I didn't pick up, there were no electric guitars in the room.
Oh, it was all these utility instruments. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
The mandolin, banjo, steel string, and nylon.
Is that the most amount of guitar players you've been in a room with at once?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Recording.
Yeah, it was 14 other guys.
You wonder what's going through someone's mind when they say, I want 15 guys, like not 8, not 12, not 16, but 15, you know?
Yeah, he was going for a sound, which to his credit, man, I think is amazing. He was going for a sound and a texture, and he said, I bet this is a cool way to get it. And he went for it, and, you know, we were able to do it. So it was really cool.
Very cool. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes.
All righty.
What's your go-to guitar right now? Has that changed over the years? And what other two or three guitars would round out your top?
I have probably two go-to guitars. The first one would be for, you know, for recording, would be a PRS, what they call a single cut 245. Scale is 24 and a half inches. It kind of looks, you know, it's got that classic, you know, LP look kind of, you know, and two humbuckers, whammy bar, and actually, you know, so that. Then there is a Valley Arts Stratocaster that is 30, had it made in 81. So what is that? 39 years old?
Everybody loves those.
Uh-huh.
Everyone.
Yeah. In fact, hang on a second.
Yeah, man, you got it?
Yeah.
Right on.
All right. Let me see. I don't know if you can see it. Oh, well, you can see it. Let me pass it by the camera.
Yeah, man. Oh, is that an ebony neck?
It is it's bird's eye maple neck.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant the fretboard. Is that ebony?
Yes. Ebony fingerboard.
God, it looks great. Okay. So if you're listening to the audio, not watching this on YouTube, ebony fretboard, it's like, brown mahogany?
Body's rosewood matched two big pieces of rosewood. And I don't know if you can see the thing in the back here.
What is that? Back neck plate. Paul Jackson Jr. Valley Arts guitar. And I can't see the date, but well, there's a date on there, it looks
1981.
Like. 1981. What color is that, man?
It's natural rosewood. It's a brown rosewood.
Really cool. And you know what makes that really cool is that I've never seen a gold pick guard like that.
Yep. It's brass. And then, you know, got the brass Floyd and
brass. Yep. Pick. Yeah. And what kind of pickups you have in there?
Bartolini, which I don't know if most guys remember those, but those were kind of some of the first quote unquote stacked noiseless Strat pickups. And I went with them and I never took them out.
Sounds good. You like it, obviously. Beautiful guitar, man.
Thank you. Yeah. So probably those two are the first two that I grab. Acoustic wise, PRS made now it's actually a private stock, but they were marketing an acoustic called the Denari. And it's a really, really amazing, well-built guitar. Actually, it's funny. They have the Denari, and now they have the Denari SE line. And the SE line is really, really, really great. I mean, I use it actually a lot for recording and for live, you know, but that the private stock one, the Denari private stock acoustic, that's the first acoustic I grabbed.
Where's that?
Probably.
Okay. Say what? No, say so where's the 335 in the mix?
I only play it at home. I only use it, you know.
Yeah, that makes sense, man. You don't want to. I can't blame you, man.
Doesn't leave the house.
good choice, man.
Right. And then for my solo stuff, I use a PRS single cut semi hollow. Yeah, and the scale on that I think is also 245. 24 and a half inches.
Any cool or interesting stories behind how you acquired any of your guitars?
Let me think. Think. Yes.
I knew you wouldn't disappoint, man. Yeah.
there was a period where I was actually, the guy that built this guitar is a guy by the name of Mike McGuire. Hmm. And years later, Mike McGuire went on to run the custom shop at Gibson.
Oh, cool.
So wherever Mike went, I went. And so Mike's making guitars and he's doing things. He said, hey, Paul, I came up with this great idea. I'm going to send you something. I said, okay. cool, I'll send you, I'll wait for it. And so in the mail arrives a hollow body Les Paul with P90s.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly.
That is really cool.
Yeah. It was unbelievable. Actually, years later, he had done the same thing. He had built a Valley Arts, another Valley Arts Strat, different from this. He said, hey, Paul, I got something for you. And I'm sitting at home, and he sends, it's a white guitar. I still have that. A white Valley Arts Strat, also with a Floyd. And but that was the funniest one, is because I had no idea what he was saying. Yeah, I got something for you. I'll send it to you. And he sends a hollow body Les Paul with P90s.
That's really cool, man. Best guitar and best amp you've ever played?
Oh, gosh. Well, the best amp I've ever played is the Paul Jackson Jr. Casio Miss MIDI.
That's right on, man.
That's the best amp I've ever played. No.
Well, man, let's talk about it since you mentioned it. You're releasing an amp this year called the Miss MIDI in honor of your grandma.
Right.
Talk about it, man. It's a signature amp. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, I was looking for something that for the working guitarist had a lot of clean headroom that would take pedals well, but also had a great overdrive sound and reverb and an effects loop, because the big thing now is doing the four cable method. So, got with Cash John, and he actually designed the amp, and we went through sound, went through tubes. So we settled on six L6s. And it's funny because I thought I wanted six V6s because they sound a little, softer, a little chimier. But we went with six L6s because I just, in this particular amp, sounded better. The amp is all hand-wired, point-to-point, three channels, effects loop, reverb, one single 12-inch speaker, and it weighs just under 40 pounds.
That's cool.
And it's small. What I wanted was an amp that would not break your back, was easily portable, but was very recordable, and would work well in a lot of different situations. So I don't think that you can make an amp that's all things to all guys. I think that's impossible.
No. Yeah, 100%.
Right. That can't happen. But for the working guitarist who wants a great sound, who has a lot of pedals that he likes, and he wants some clean, some dirty, he wants a great overdrive tone, that's what we went for. And I think we achieved it.
And so you've got an overdrive channel and a reverb tank in there.
Yeah. Well, no, not a reverb. We went with a digital reverb for space and reliability. Yeah.
That's very cool.
But everything else is all tube rectifier. And it's going to be one of the least expensive. The reason we decided to go with reverb is so we can keep the price down. Because when you're dealing with point to point, the price starts going way up.
Yes. So
if we're selling it on reverb, we're able to keep the price reasonably. I think it's going to come in right around $2,000.
Very cool, man. So you have a rectifier in that. What's the wattage?
The wattage is 35 watts RMS.
Very cool. And so the rectifier can take it down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it can also use a solid state rectifier if you want to do that. But
I wish you a lot of luck. When does it come out? It
comes out later this year. I got to talk to John about, when we can actually launch.
Very cool. And it'll be out. Where would people find out about it?
You can go to I got a video on YouTube, and then you can go to Casha Amplifiers. .com and
spell that, please.
Casha, KASHA.
Cool.
Now, another funny story. Amplifier story. So, back in the mid 70s, Jay Graydon got with Paul Rivera, who at that time was making pedal boards. He was the original pedal board king. He's making pedal boards and modding amps. And so he was modding Fender Princetons and Fender Deluxes to make the overdrive better and make them smoother. And so Jay Graydon got with him and said, can you make a variable mid-range boost that boosts different amounts at, different frequencies? And Paul said, yeah, I can do that. So he had a six-position mid-range boost, rewired the amps, put a master volume in, and did some other stuff that's really cool. And every studio guy in LA had these amplifiers, every single person. And that amp, the Paul Rivera modified Princeton and the Paul Rivera modified Deluxe, is on more hits and more records than Dumble ever was.
Interesting, man.
Yeah. For instance, like the solo on Peg that Jay Graydon did.
Yes.
That's a Rivera modified Deluxe.
Now, did this basically start his amp company?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So everybody had one. Fast forward 40 years, nobody has one. Very, very few people have them. I have two. And the last price I got offered, somebody offered me $15,000 for one of them. And I said, no.
Yeah.
Nope. Yeah. In fact, in my will, I have left a Valley Arts Strat to each kid and a Paul Revere modified amp to each kid.
Wow, that's testamentary assets there, man. That's like pretty important.
So Paul goes on to, I think he worked for Mesa Boogie for that long. Then he went and worked for Fender and designed a couple of really cool amps at Fender. There's one tube amp he designed for Fender. I can't remember the name of it, but it was channel switching, had reverb. It was all tube. It had a great overdrive sound. And then something happened and he left and he said, I'm going to go ahead and start my own company. But that's what launched Rivera Amps.
That's a really cool story, man.
Yeah. Was the amps he was modding in the 70s. He worked at Red Rhodes Amplifier Shop. That's where he first started working.
See, that should be in his marketing. The only amp in Paul Jackson Jr.'s will is a Rivera.
Right.
That would be in my marketing, I'll tell you that much.
But this is before Dumble and before, you know, all the guys were, you know, he was modding the amps and then got with Jay Graydon, and it literally is a studio, like a studio legacy. Everybody had them.
That's really cool. You ever sell a guitar you wish you can get back?
No.
How many guitars do you have? Ballpark.
Ballpark, maybe, you know, acoustics and everything included, maybe about 30.
That's really reasonable.
Yeah. Well, my thing was I would never buy a guitar I knew I wasn't going to play.
Yeah.
So I didn't get a lot of vintage instruments and a lot of things that were going to sit around the house. So it was only guitars I was actually going to play. And then, you know, if I got something that was better than what I had, I'd give the other one away or something like that. So give some away and sold a couple, you know, but yeah, so probably about 30.
Yeah, that's super reasonable. Do you remember the first record you purchased on your
first record I purchased?
Yeah.
It was probably a Temptations record or something when I was like, you know, 9 or 10 years old. And interesting, I tell my students, I say, you know, everybody is mad about the advent of, you know, iTunes and all that kind of stuff. I said, let me tell you one cool thing. One of the cool things is when I was a kid, you could go to a record store. And their first question is, what's a record store? Second question is, what's a record? No.
Right.
But I digress. You could go to a record
what's
store.
What's a record?
A piece of vinyl about this big with a hole in it.
Yeah. Or
a piece of vinyl about this big with a little hole in it. Okay, but you could go to a record store and you and I could walk out with a piece of music for a dollar.
Yeah.
So fast forward, you know, we have iTunes and Amazon Music and all the other ones, YouTube Music and whatever. And you can own a piece of music for a dollar.
Yeah.
That's pretty, you know, pretty cool.
More things change.
But I think it was probably like a Temptations record or something like that. Maybe Ball of Confusion or Papa Was a Rolling Stone or something like that.
You know what, man? As soon as you said Temptations, I started thinking of Papa Was a Rolling Stone. They do not make music. I don't want to sound like an old guy, but they don't make music like that anymore, man.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you don't hear that stuff. I wish that you did, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Knee-jerk reaction, top three Desert Island discs, just for now.
Oh, shoot. Probably George Benson's Good King Bad. Pat Martino's Consciousness is a live record. And what else? Oh, shoot. Probably Steely Dan's Asia record.
And you knew, and you have worked with all the guys that made those records.
Yeah, well, I didn't work, unfortunately, haven't worked. Well, I did work with Pat Martino. I take that back. Ah! We did Burke's Jazz Festival one year. It was funny. My dad went with me. Funny story. And we did a tribute to Wes Montgomery. So it was Larry Carlton, Earl Klugh, Pat Martino, Russell Malone. I'm forgetting a guitarist, a great guitar player from Philly. And then yours truly. So we're playing different things, so different guys playing. Pat Martino played, and then Russell comes out and plays Cherokee and kills it. It's amazing. And I'm backstage with my dad. I said, "Hey, Dad, how'd I do?" He said, "Well, I got to be honest, son. I think tonight you came in third."
That's awesome, man. That's so cool. That's a good one, man. Yeah, you came in third.
So,
I think you came in third. That's good, man. Very funny.
Yeah. But yeah, so yeah, I actually did work with Pat Martino at Burke's Jazz Festival.
I want to ask you a question. You had mentioned your faith several times. Talk about that for yourself. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me get a specific question. Or how has your faith helped you? I mean, how has your faith helped you get through life? Let's just say like that. That's a pretty good, you know.
Well, I tell people that Christianity is not something that I do. It's who I am. And there's a scripture in the Bible that said, if you acknowledge the Lord in all of your ways, he'll direct your path. And also the steps of a righteous man are ordered by God. So every morning my prayer is order my steps and direct my path. And that's how I look at life. And everything, you know, and sometimes people use it as a cliche or, you know, but I use it as a starting point of power where every day I ask the Lord to direct my path in anything I do, you know, buying a guitar, buying a car, buying a house, you know, career choices. I always pray about it. And the reason I tell people this, I say, listen, if God is who he says he is, then he's all powerful. He knows everything and he can be everywhere at the same time. And those are three things that I can't do. So figure if he is all powerful, knows everything and can be everywhere at the same time, then he can run my life better than I can.
Yeah.
So me being a Christian is a point of being pragmatic and realizing that if he created this world and he knows can do all those things that I can't, then he can run my life better than I can. And so it's like I said, it's who I am.
That's awesome, man. And I know it governs because the way, you know, you've mentioned it several times and the comfort that you take in that is comforting to me to listen to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's kind of like recently, you know, I told you my mom 2 years ago, but, you know, right after that was Chuck Loeb and then right after that was Ndugu Chancellor, great drummer. Then right after that was Wawa Watson. And there's been this litany of people passing away, not the least of which was my father-in-law just over the holidays, And there's a scripture in 1 Corinthians that says, "Is in this life is the only place that we have hope. Then we're the most miserable people in the world." And the fact of the matter is there's hope of heaven. And heaven is a reality. So it's kind of like, okay, you know, everybody's got to get out of here. You know, nobody makes it out of here alive.
Yeah.
The question is what happens when you leave? And the comfort is knowing that not only are they okay, but I'm going to be okay. And while I'm here, I'm going to be okay. So
thank you, man. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate
it. You're very welcome.
Tell me what's the best decision you ever made.
Wow. Well, let's see. Well, I'll tell you the best decision my mother ever made first.
All right.
When I was a kid, I wanted to play the drums. So she took me to Gardena Valley Music, and there was a blue Metal Flake set of drums. I couldn't tell you the brand. All I remember was blue and it was Metal Flake sitting in the window, and it was $369. And my mom said, "That is not going to happen." So we go in the store and she said, "Is anything else in here you like?" And there was a $20 guitar hanging from the ceiling. That's how I started playing the guitar. So best decision she ever made.
Wow.
Best decision I ever made was giving my life to Jesus. That's the first thing. The second best decision, and I better say this to have it on record, is marrying my wife, Michelle.
Yeah, man.
That was the best decision I ever made. And
that's everybody. Most of the time when I ask that question, if it's a guy, he looks around and if his wife's there, he goes, marrying my wife.
Marrying my wife. Best decision. And probably recently the best decision was having bought Tesla stock.
There you go.
I don't know.
We got everything here on this show, man. We got financial planning. We got worship services. We got it all, man.
The funny thing to talk about that is Ray Parker Jr.
Yeah.
Not only is my hero in the guitar world, he's also one of my financial advisors.
That's cool, man.
And before I would make any financial step, I would pray about it. I'd talk to my dad and I would talk to Ray. And he's the one that told me about different ways to save and pension plans and, you know, different things to invest in. And he told me something that I recently told my student. My student asked me about a certain amp or pedal or something like that. And I said, this is something I learned from Ray, is only buy stuff that you can sell. Only buy something that has some value and will have some value to somebody else. Because if you ever get stuck, you're not stuck. You can sell it and make some money.
Yeah.
You know? And so, even before, you know, the current house we live in, same thing. We prayed about it. Talked to my dad, talked to Ray. So he also is one of my my financial advisors.
Hey, man, that's great. Yeah. You know what? I wish every musician had a Ray Parker to go to.
Oh, yeah.
Seriously, because, you know, a lot of guys that are our age that, you know, made money don't necessarily have it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And have you always been good about going to others for help?
Yeah.
That's cool.
I learned how to engineer. Learn how to record, learn how to sequence with synthesizers, all from asking questions from people. Huh. I'd sit in the studio and ask, you know, why do you use this mic? How does a 57 sound different than a 47 FET? You know, why are you using those for overheads? You know, what's the compressor do? What's the best compressor? What's this? What's that? You know, what's a good way to EQ? Why are you using 250, 3K, and 10K? You know, what's the difference between Class A and Class AB? All these things are things that I learned just from asking questions. So I've always been kind of inquisitive, and I've always been fortunate to be around older people that would help me.
Yeah, that's the key.
The biggest thing, you know. And so, you know, like somebody said once, there's no such thing as a dumb question. And that's really true. And,
yeah.
My parents got the brunt of it, you know, of
just, hey, but that's what they signed up for, man. You know,
hey, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's like you signed up for it. So here you go.
They brought you into this world. You didn't bring, right. You know, you didn't like just pop up. It was a yeah, man. So, yeah. You know, that's what I keep reminding myself. You know, you have kids over the years and like, you know,
right.
You know, I signed up for this, man. You know, I got to fulfill my commitment here, you know. Tell me, this is going to be a tough one for you. Best childhood memory. You got a lifetime of great memories with your childhood.
I don't know. Wow, let's see. Oh, shoot. Going to Disneyland is a big one. And it's funny. Disneyland recently has raised their one-day ticket price to $200.
Dude, how does the average because we're in Florida, and Disney World, they just sent a notice. How does the average maybe unskilled laborer, how do they do that?
It's interesting you say that because I don't know. And that brings me to my point. Folks, my dad would get through his job, he would get these tickets to go to Disneyland. And the first time I took my kids, man, I had a hole in my wallet just parking.
Yes.
So I get to the booth and we bought tickets. And literally, after we bought tickets, I called my dad on the phone and said, "Hey, Pop, thank you. I just bought tickets to Disneyland. We're not in the park yet. And I only have two kids. You had four. So this is ridiculous."
Seriously, man. I mean, and you go there and you see people walking around with four kids and I'm like, I don't know how they're doing this.
Yeah. So that was that, you know, going to Disneyland as a kid with my folks. Another interesting memory with my folks. My dad, once again, through his job, used to get tickets to different things. So he got, there was a fundraiser for, I think it was for the Brotherhood Crusade, Shrine Auditorium. And the guests were Les McCann and Richard Pryor. I'm 13 years old. And my parents really didn't shield us from anything. So I'm 13 years old listening to, you know, Les McCann, you know, he's cussing. But then we get to Richard Pryor. And Richard is in rare form. And I'm 13 years old listening to Richard Pryor. That's one of my fondest memories, because I'm like, what parent in their right mind would take their 13-year-old kid to go see Richard Pryor?
No, but that was really cool. Were your parents very religious as well?
Not per se. No, not really.
But that was really cool back in the day that they were that open. I mean, you sound like you have very cool parents in general, man. How supportive. Yeah.
You know, so that.
That's funny, man.
Yeah. Oh, well, that wasn't really a childhood memory. No, that was later. That was a lot later. But there were a lot of things like that. You know, just hanging out with my folks was just an everyday cool occurrence. You know, being at home, and you know, so yeah, you know, just in general. And like I said, probably obviously the day that the 335 showed up.
Man, I can't. That had to be so special, man.
Yeah, that was amazing. Oh, I tell you another childhood memory that was good is. Like I said, I used to play with a group called the Don Johnson Society Orchestra. Another story. Don Johnson at the time in Los Angeles was like king of the casuals. And what Don would do is he would have three or four bands running on the same night as the Don Johnson Society Orchestra.
Okay. So you mean like casuals, like weddings, bar mitzvahs, things like that?
Yeah. Parties, you know, dances. Yeah. So what he would do, he played trumpet. He would go to one gig, play trumpet, play a set, collect the money. Second one, play trumpet, play a set, collect the money, and go on. So, and I played with Don for at least a year. But I remember we were playing at the Century Plaza Hotel. And my dad used to go with me sometimes, and he went on this gig because I was 16, 17 years old. And I remember I used to have to wear a blue tuxedo jacket, a white tuxedo jacket, tuxedo shirt, bow tie, and polyester black pants. And that was a uniform. So, and I remember sitting up playing, and I'm playing, and I'm playing. And I see my dad dozing off in the back. And so about 1-2 o'clock in the morning, I said, okay, Dad. I said, okay, let's go. So that was one of my fondest memories, of seeing my dad sit in the back. Of some of these gigs, falling asleep, you know, while I'm playing. So yeah, so
no, but that's really cool, because that shows that's the love, man. That he,
yeah, you absolutely, know,
yeah, man. That's a very cool thing. I could totally dig that, man. Yeah, that's nice. Do you have any non-musical superpowers?
Training dogs.
Talk to me about that. That's interesting.
Well, interesting story. My buddy, Ollie Brown, once again.
The drummer.
Yes. Had imported a German Shepherd dog from Germany. And he had moved to a house that didn't have a big backyard, and he had a koi pond, and the dog kept eating his koi.
Just imagine coming home and like seeing the like little bits of like a tail, and then like a fin here. It's like on a daily basis.
Smile on the dog, you know, the dog laying and smiling. What do you want? I'm a dog. Where am I going? Oh, you're going? They were delicious. So he put the dog in the kennel for a while. Then I moved into a house with a big backyard. He said, hey, why don't you take the dog? So I had purchased a German Shepherd dog from a pet store. Then he brings me his dog. They were like two different dogs.
Yeah, two different
breeds. So I wanted to figure out, why are these dogs so different? So I started getting into what, you know, lines were and training and things like that. And my buddy Sonny Burke at the time, keyboard player, was very into dogs. And he introduced me to a guy by the name of Tony Rollins. And so on the weekends, we would go and train the dogs in obedience and then protection, where a guy would put on a sleeve and some suits, and we'd send the dogs, and I put on sleeves and suits, and so that got me into dogs. And so to this day, I have two German Shepherd dogs, and they're both trained in protection and obedience, and I train them in German, and so that's one of my non-musical superpowers.
That's cool, man. And those, because I've seen the dogs, they look different. They're like the Porsche of German Shepherds.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. They're really sleek and they're just really cool looking, man.
So that's one of my non-musical superpowers.
Man, did you like strap a koi fish to the sleeve?
At that point, you don't have to. I mean, the dogs are trained to go after the man. So, you know, you put on either a sleeve or a biaxial suit that's a big padded burlap suit.
Yeah.
And the dog will, you know, bite you in the arm, bite you in the leg, you know, whatever. You know, and I used to wear groin protection because sometimes dogs will bite you in the groin or,
yeah,
you know, whatever. So, and then, you know, being obedience. And what I realized was that when a dog is potentially dangerous, the first thing you need to know is how to get the dog off of someone and make sure the dog listens to you. Because heaven forbid, you know, somebody's walking by and your front door is open. And it happens, unfortunately, all the time.
Sure.
Somebody's walking by with their dog, or they're walking by, they're running or whatever. And dogs have certain drives, two of which are play drive and prey drive. So a lot of dogs, when they see little kids running, they associate it with food. And they don't mean any harm. They say, oh, that looks like food. I'm going to go get it.
Totally, you know? Makes sense.
But if you have a dog that is not trained to listen to you and stop on command, then you're going to have a problem. And so that's one of the things I wanted to make sure I knew, how to control a dog that was potentially, you know, going to be a danger to someone.
How long does it take? And like, what was it, like, you know, half hour a day for 3 months? Like, how does that, you know?
Well, you know, training actually could be, you know, like the class would be like an hour, you know, protection class might be an hour. And then for obedience, you work a little bit every day with the dog, you know, half an hour. And then you're always training. Like, for instance, when I'm working with the dogs, one of the things that I learned from Caesar Milan is that the dog is never supposed to go out of the door before you do. It's a respect thing. So one of the things I do is I tell my dogs to lay down. I'll open the door. I'll walk out, and then I'll tell them, okay, and then they can come out.
So
you don't have dogs just darting out the door. You know, and so everything is a training exercise. You know, feeding time is a training exercise. You know, even, you know, for instance, the best way to housebreak a dog is you use a kennel box, you know, and when you can't watch the puppy, you keep them in a kennel box because a dog will not go to the bathroom where they sleep.
Right.
So the dog will bang on the box or say, hey, I need to go. You take the dog out immediately out of the same door every time you go. So the dog associates, says, oh, we're going outside to use the bathroom. Take them to the same place while they're using the bathroom. You pet them, tell them good, 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 good. Bring them back to the house, play with them. When you can't watch them, put them back in the kennel box. And so gradually, as they get the routine down, you let them out of the box, run around, because they will always come and get you when they have to go out of the bathroom. You take them out the same way.
That's really cool.
But yeah. So you learn, you know, different things.
Man, I love animals. And it, you know, it's so sad. Not to be a downer. Because I'm on like different animal, just because I don't watch anything negative, like politics or nothing like that. But I like watching animals. But man, I didn't realize how many people are abusive to animals, man. It's nuts.
Yeah, you kind of don't understand why people are abusive to anything, you know, and it's just, you know, to each other.
Of course.
To animals, to, you know, and you kind of just kind of scratch your head and, you know, if you're going to abuse something or someone, maybe it's, you know, best to not be in association with them. You know, if you're going to abuse your kids, maybe don't have any kids.
Or
if you think you're going to abuse a kid, let a relative adopt them or heaven, you know, forbid, if you don't want your baby, you know, bring it to a fire station or whatever you need to do. And same thing with animals. You know, if you're going to abuse the animals, then, you know, give them to a friend or take them to the shelter or something, but don't abuse them. But it kind of boggles your mind.
Yeah, it's incredibly predatory, man. I just don't get that, man. It's crazy. Interesting question. Has your life been different than what you imagined?
Absolutely. For one thing, I didn't think I would be playing this much guitar after 4 years. I feel like, especially trying to keep up with Jeff Lorber, that I'm playing some of my best guitar in my life. He pushes me, and so does Everett, for that matter. I mean, you know, these guys are amazing. Didn't realize I'd be a professor of music at the college that I attended. Didn't realize that for all this time, I'd still be working with people like The Weeknd and Nipsey Hussle, you know, which keeps me relevant.
Yes. I like that.
And like I said, being able to do things like the Oscars, you know, I'm having a blast, you know, but never thought that, it would be like this. So I'm enjoying the ride.
Man, you've had a lot of blessings, but you've accepted everything with so much humility, you know, it's very nice to see. A couple more questions, man. Absolutely. You have any hobbies outside of dogs, outside of music?
Yes.
I knew you would. You're an interesting cat, man.
Bad hobby to have, really, really bad hobby, is muscle cars, old cars.
Uh-huh.
I have a 1969 Oldsmobile 442. By the way, we have the famous, we did a episode of Jay Leno. I played guitar in the Tonight Show band for 3.5 years. And Jay featured my car on one of his shows. And it's the show where we actually dented the headers.
Oh, man.
Yeah, well, at that time, you know, like, headers are really weird because it's hard to find headers that fit. And so we put some headers that we knew were not great on the car. And sure enough, we dented them. But I had some custom headers made since then. But so I have a 1969 Oldsmobile 442 and a 1966 Chevy El Camino.
Oh, those are badass, man.
Yeah. So those are fun. So and a 1987 Harley Davidson FXRP that I had rebuilt. So, old cars and motorcycles, like I said, a bad hobby to have because money pits.
Yeah, they are.
What else?
Do you ride your bike? Your Harley?
I ride it around the neighborhood. I don't ride it far. I just putter on it,
No.
Go to Starbucks.
Those, they're dangerous, man. I think that's smart, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. I have a jacket, literally, that's an airbag. There's a jacket. I kid you not. It's called a Hit Air Jacket. It's got a CO2 cartridge. It's chambered, and it's got a tether that you attach to your handlebars. If you ever come off the bike, the tether pulls the CO2 cartridge, and the jacket inflates.
Yeah, man, that's smart.
It's an airbag, so that's my jacket.
That's, you know, if you're riding a bike, from, this is what everybody tells me anyway, like down a little country road, it's beautiful. But when you're riding a bike on a highway in L.A., it's like a danger, you know, an accident waiting to happen, man.
And that's the thing. It's like, I'm not trying to get on the freeway and ride a bike. It's not transportation. You know, it's, people going around 20, 30 miles an hour is about all I can stand.
Yeah, man, I hear you.
I ride around the neighborhood, and just, that's about it, you know. But old cars is probably my biggest hobby, and probably not a good hobby to have. But yeah, my dad got me into that. That's a long story.
That's cool, man. It sounds like fun. Yeah. Toughest decision you had to make, or most difficult thing you've had to do?
Wow. Toughest decision I had to make. That would be of a personal nature, and that was getting a divorce.
I feel you.
That was the toughest decision.
Yeah, they're hard to getting married. This was my experience anyway. Is hard enough.
Yeah,
but it's a natural thing.
Yeah,
unwinding it, not natural.
Well, I describe, the Bible describes it as a tearing away, and God hates it because of what it does to people. And I describe divorce as a lose-lose.
Oh, yeah, man. It's only, it's degrees of loss, man. There's no winning there. Like,
how badly do you lose? It's not.
Yeah, there's no winning.
Nobody wins.
Yeah,
man. One of those kind of things. You know, so that was probably the hardest decision, primarily because of the kids,
Sure.
And it takes, it takes a long time to kind of get back, in terms of, relationships and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's probably the hardest decision.
Thank you, man. But you've been married. How long have you been married now this time?
8 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're congratulations.
That's cool, man. This is my second and final 27. We've been together. So
there you go.
Yeah, man. Last question. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional and how much is a natural part of aging? You're laughing, so you're going to have a good story here.
Well, I used to really be concerned about what people thought. Now I can really care less because everybody's got an opinion.
Man, don't they?
And the drag is it always changes. That's the drag. You know, did you lose weight? Yeah, I did. Okay, good. Next time I see you. Did you gain weight? Well, from, yeah, a year ago or 2 years. Yeah, I did. Oh, okay. You know, whatever it is, you know, everybody always has an opinion of something that you're doing or not doing. And it always changes. And now I just really don't care.
That's good, man. That's no, it's good. Liberating when you don't care because you just sleep easier.
And I think my mom was the biggest proponent of low tolerance for stupidity. I have inherited her trait. If I used to have a longer fuse for things that were obviously
stupid,
you know, and I'm not talking about people not knowing things or trying. And I'm just saying, you know, like just dumb.
I get it, man. You know?
And now I have kind of a low tolerance for people that just want to be stupid for stupid's sake.
Yeah.
And like, you know, because it's funny. The one thing that you'll never get more of is time.
I was just thinking, you can make money. You can't make time, man.
Can't make time.
Yeah.
You know, buy another house, buy another car, buy another guitar.
Right.
Like the red one on the wall. Anyway. but you'll never get, is that a 335 with a Bigsby? Or?
It is. It's not a vintage, though. It looks vintage. Man, this is like a 2013, and I was in Nashville looking for one, and a buddy of mine is what's his name's tech? Tim McGraw's guitar tech for like 25 years.
Wow.
And so I asked him to help me find one, and we called up, and the guy said, but it's got an aftermarket Bigsby. And I said, well, I thought of an idiot like myself in the garage drilling holes, and I'm like, well, maybe not. But John spoke to him, and it turns out it's aftermarket, but the guy worked at Gibson. So he bought it from Gibson and put it on right there. And that's why it has that custom made to look like a vintage. So it's like a 2013, my favorite guitar by far. I love it.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful.
It feels so, I'm not a big guy. The neck is, it's beautiful, man.
I have little kind of little funny hands too. And yeah, necks are interesting, you know, for me, but yeah, that's beautiful. But anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest change in my personality is that, you know.
Less tolerance, suffer fools. You don't suffer fools easily, man.
You know, if you're just stuck on being stupid, it's kind of like, you know, guys, you know, but like you said, you never get more time. So
absolutely, man. Let me tell people what you got going on. But first of all, I just want to thank you, man. It's been a pleasure talking. You've been so sincere and so kind. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Greg.
It's you know, clear to me, like, why, you know, all the stuff going on, why you're so successful and your approach to everything, man. So thank you for sharing that with everybody. I want to tell people a few things you got going on. I'd love everybody to check out some things that Paul's working on and has. First of all, his record, Stories from Stompin' Willie. We talked about George Duke gave him that nickname. That's kind of like his homage to George. So go listen to that album. It's available wherever records or whatever they call them now, whatever, download. Wherever download stream albums. Yeah. You can look forward to in the next few months more stories from Stompin' Willie. That's kind of be like part two. He also has a record I mentioned earlier, Life and Times with Jazz Funk Soul. That's his project with Jeff Lorber and Everett Harp. Again, it's available wherever albums are available to stream. And you can look forward to his signature amp. It's really your grandmother's signature amp, man.
I guess it would be her signature.
It's Paul's grandmother's signature.
He didn't play much guitar, but hey, great grandma.
Yeah. The Miss MIDI. It'll be available on Reverb. It's for working musicians that are looking for something that accepts pedals very well with clean headroom. It's got a distortion channel and a reverb on there. And also, if you want to connect with Paul on social media, he's on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Jackson Jr.
Also, the website too, pauljacksonjr.com. Yeah,
pauljacksonjr.com. Anything else I forgot or I missed or you want to talk
about?
No,
you're right on the money.
Man, thank you. So are you. Thank you for everything, man. I really appreciate your time, man. Thank you. You're
Thank you, bro.
You're a cool dude, man. Hang on one second. Let me wrap up. Everybody, okay. thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Much thanks to Paul Jackson Jr. Please check out all the things he's got going on. Stories from Stompin' Willie. More stories that'll be coming out. Life and Times with Jazz, Funk, Soul, and his grandmother's signature amp, the Miss Midi. And I'm sure he'll be talking about that on his social media channels as well.
Absolutely.
Most important, don't forget that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out.
Yay.
Paul, thank you so much, brother.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.